Okay, so I'm going to talk about that parable that Luke just read then from Luke 19, which sits uncomfortably with me when I just read it like that. I'm going to talk about a few different ways that you can read this parable, and they don't all come to the same conclusion. So rather than make that conclusion for you, I'm going to present a few different ways and allow you to discern what you feel is the best way to interpret that today. And it could be that it means all those things, depending on where you're at in your life. It's a parable that appears in Luke and also in Matthew. And it's not quite the same in the two, but it's similar. In Matthew, you'd probably know it as the parable of the talents. And it's predominantly the same, but it doesn't have the framing of the nobleman going away to be appointed king and coming back at the end. That's only in Luke, that framing. And that's the really big difference between the two. Other details are the number of coins is different, the type of coin, the number of servants, what they do. The third servant in Matthew buries his coin and in Luke puts it in a piece of cloth. But that framing is the biggest difference. So much so that quite a lot of the commentators believe that in Luke we've got two separate parables that have been edited together but were originally intended as two separate stories, one about a king going away and returning, and one about the use of the coins. You've heard me speak before, and I have a very high view of if the author of the gospel has edited them together, that there's a reason for them to be edited together, even if they were originally two separate stories. So I'm going to predominantly look at it as a piece, as held together, but you might consider that really it should be pulled apart. The story's got a different context in the two Gospels and possibly has a different meaning in the two Gospels. In Matthew, it's between the story of the bridesmaids, attendants of the groom, who are waiting for the groom to come, and they run out of oil, and when the groom finally comes, they're not ready. And then you've got the talents, and then you've got the sheep and the goats. So it's within a context of probably about talking about the end times and being ready, paying attention to the good things you've got, that kind of a theme. It's also told with much greater hyperbole in Matthew, and that's a question if we were looking at that one, but we're not going to look at that one. Jesus probably told the parable more than once. Like any good preacher, he would reuse his material, and possibly himself told the same stories to mean different things depending on where and how he told them. But certainly the people editing and writing the Gospels told their stories and took their stories to address two different communities, to address different periods and different contexts. So it's okay to say that nearly the same story could be intended to mean two different things in two different places. So in Luke, we're in chapter 19. Now, last time I got up to speak here, I was talking about chapter 18, about the explosion of grace in chapter 18, about God welcoming us in our usness, welcoming you in your you-ness before any of the good or evil you do piles on top of that. And then after that, we get the story of Zacchaeus, where salvation comes to the house of the one most hated. And Zacchaeus responds to that by saying, "Oh, I'm going to give back the money." And Jesus basically just ignores that and says, "Salvation has come because this man is a son of Abraham," which I take as another way of saying, "because this man is beloved of God," the theme that chapter 18 was bringing in. And then this parable is told, and the lead-in specifically says it's told to those who've just witnessed this event with Zacchaeus. So there's something out of the story of Zacchaeus that rises up the need to tell this story. Immediately after this parable, Jesus enters into Jerusalem on a donkey. So this is where we've got the story in Luke, quite different in that way to where it is in Matthew. If you're a limited listener, only able to concentrate on some bits today, I'm sorry, I haven't got a whole lot of little neat catchphrases as we go today. But if you don't have the brain energy to process a whole lot of different interpretations of the parable, then feel free to just drift off for a while, and I'll call you back when I get to the one that I'm holding today. Or just drift in and out as you can. A couple of kind of notes before we start about bits within the parable, a mina or a mina, the coin that they're given, is the approximately 100 denarii. Now, we know a denarii is about the wage, a day's wage for a labourer, probably. So this is a coin of a mina is about 3 months' wages to a basic wage labourer. I suppose today that'd be about $5,000. A talent in Matthew is actually a weight rather than a coinage, although it becomes used for a coinage. As a weight, it's between about 26 to 33 kilograms, possibly up to 41 kilograms, which if you can imagine if that's of silver or something, that's a lot of money. When used as a coin, it's probably about 60 minas, about 6,000 denarii, or 16 and a half years day labouring wages. So in Matthew, we're talking about an amount that's ridiculous, really. So you're into a level of hyperbole. And in the mina in Luke, it's possible could be meant to be used realistically. It's a sum somebody might give you, but not a talent. The third servant is told, you should have put the money in the bank, is the translation. We all know there's no banks in first century Palestine. The word is the word for table. Trapeza, table. But already in that period, it's used to mean the money changers' table. It was against Jewish law to charge interest to Jews, but you could charge interest to foreigners. But there was cunning use of the language that you were able to loan money for a business loan and share in the profits of the business. That wasn't interest. So there was a practice of giving the money to the money changers technically to be a business loan and profiting off it. So that's when they say a bank, it's not our sort of bank, but it is a return for giving the money to someone else. To bury money was considered a legitimate and prudent thing to do if you were looking after someone else's money. You were legally not responsible if money you were minding got stolen after you'd buried it. But that's money you were minding for someone. At the start of Luke's gospel passage, it says, trade with this. So the money's not given to them just to mind. It's quite deliberately framed as that. But whatever reason you were given money for, to wrap it up in a cloth, the Mishnah, the rabbinic teaching of the time, said that was irresponsible to hang it in a cloth. And the word for cloth used is the word for a cloth you wipe sweat with. So a bandana or a hanky. It was careless, it was explicitly in the teaching of the time that it was careless to carry your money wrapped up in a cloth like that. So that gives us some understanding of bits and pieces as we go into the story. So a range of interpretations. The one you're probably most familiar with is that the point of this story is that God has given you something that you need to make good use of, and for which you'll eventually be judged. Does that sound familiar? The thing that often varies then is what it is we think you've been given. Maybe it refers to your natural God-given abilities. And in fact, the word talent in our English language stems from that interpretation of this parable. It was not in English at all as a word, or in Greek as a word to mean anything but money, until we began interpreting this parable to mean your natural abilities, and therefore the word talent became our English word for your God-given abilities. Or perhaps the thing you've been given is wealth or other physical resources, your health, land, education, your Western privilege, my Western privilege. Or perhaps the thing you've been given to take care of and use is the gospel. The good news, the other story relating to this is if you put it under a tub, it's not benefiting anyone. Here's another way of saying the gospel, make sure your light is on the hill and not buried. Or related, perhaps the thing that we've been given is the kingdom, a kernel of the kingdom which we are to nurture and grow. Perhaps the thing that's been given is the law, and this is addressed specifically to a Jewish community, and especially to Jewish leaders, and are being accused of refusing to let that grow, hoarding the law rather than letting it do what it was intended to do, which was the promises of the Old Testament, to reach out and be a light to all the nations. Perhaps the thing that's been given is each other, that we are gifted, our families and our communities. Do we tend them with love, or do we fail to recognise them and eventually have them fail to prosper and be taken from us? Perhaps the thing we've been given is our children. Now, that's a very scary thought for me, that perhaps this is about being judged on my parenting. Have I brought to fullness the sacred trust of the people I've been given into my care? Perhaps the thing that's been given is my created self. Am I living myself, or am I hiding myself? If I close down my true self, do I end up losing it entirely? And it values neither myself nor anyone around me. You can probably think of other possibilities within this broad framework of we have been given something good that is intended to be used and not hidden. And how you use it, this story says, will determine how things end up between you and God. Within that, you can either emphasise the how you live well now part of it, or you can emphasise the how God will judge you at the end part of it, but it's within the same framing. And some of the issues it's talking about then, the master has set this scenario up as a test within this framework. It's a what would you do if I wasn't watching test. It's a classic ancient way of setting up a test for people. The master goes away and there's something, well, how do they act while he's gone? But what is being tested? It's not clear. Is the test a test of trustworthiness? The language of reward is that you've been trustworthy in little, so you will gain much. A reward for those who understood what the master was on about and could be trusted to act in response. Is it a test of stewardship? Using resources to increase their value, seeing that things are given for a purpose and ensuring that that purpose is met. Is it a test of our response to a debt? That we owe something back to God? Are we cognizant of our obligation? Is it a test of our love of the master? Because using a gift shows that you value the giver. Wrapping it in a hanky says, I don't value this gift, I don't value this giver. The coins are the master's presence while the master's away. Hiding them says, I don't want that master in my life. Is it a test of boldness? A failure to risk is the evil of the third servant. The language is actually quite strong. The third servant is called evil. Is playing it safe insufficient? Is that what's being tested? Connected, is it a test of faith? That lives of self-abandonment and risk show a confidence in the master. Those first two servants show a willingness to trust their future to him rather than playing safe and keeping it to themselves. Now, I affirm the general God gives us good things for a purpose that we should use them theme. But once it gets linked to, or else you will get punished, then I think it no longer reflects the wider context of the gospel, the overall themes and tones, and particularly following from chapter 18, where God is so welcoming and loving. So that traditional framing of it, I think, raises lots of really good questions for us to think about how we live. But if we take it as a measure of how we will be judged, I think we need to move into other ways of reading the parable. So here's some other ways. You're all looking quite worried there, because I think you think, God, she's standing quite legalistic there. It's not what we expect. But I hold that it is a valid way to read it. And I've said this many times. There are multiple valid ways to read it. And each valid way raises things that are tricky. And each valid way has things that affirm us. And whichever is our natural preference, I think it's important that we hear the other valid ways as well. So another way to look at this is perhaps the point of this parable is to explain why Jesus is not the king yet and what to do in the meantime. At verse 11, it says, Jesus heard that there was expectations that the kingdom was about to come, and so he told them this parable. They've just seen this incident with Zacchaeus. Salvation has come to this house. Perhaps they hear salvation and they think, that's it. That's the uprising we're waiting for. So when that's spoken by Jesus, it's addressed to people anticipating that walking into Jerusalem, he's going to overthrow the Romans. When it's written down and passed on by the gospel writer of Luke, it's told to people struggling with the gap of absence. Jesus has gone away and he didn't overthrow the Romans. And the parable says, don't despair, that was in the plan. He's busy off getting all kinged up and he's going to come back in godly power. And just make sure you're doing your best with what's been left behind in the meantime, referred to previous section. So it's addressing two concerns. Don't disengage is the key message then. Don't disengage. Don't disengage because you think Jesus is coming back any minute. There's a life to be lived now, so you can't just say, oh, Jesus is coming, I don't have to engage with what's been left. But also, don't disengage from the call of Jesus because you think Jesus is gone forever. And you see the two possible extremes of that dealing with the absence. He is coming back eventually, and he does care what you're doing in the meantime. And then you get the call of to be ready, the readiness. This interpretation is probably stronger if we're reading it in Matthew than if we're reading it in Luke, because he's in a series about readiness there. Readiness, though, is not sitting at the door waiting for someone to turn up. It's getting on with the tasks of life with a preparedness to drop it all and go when you need to. One of the commentators I read, Richard T. France, says, God is not a rapacious capitalist, but he's not content with inaction. And avoiding doing wrong does not equal doing right. This is why the Lutheran liturgy I grew up with, every Sunday we confessed our sins. Not personally on a list, thank goodness, but we as a community confessed that we were sinful people. And the wording we said every week was, for what we have done and for what we have failed to do. I can see former Anglicans nodding their heads. Because inaction can be as abruptly offensive to the gospel as action. This parable, though, is not showing us what to do while he's away. This parable, then, is about motivating you to care what you do while he's away, and then refer to rest of gospel for how to orient yourself into that waiting and readiness. That assumes that Jesus spoke to say the kingdom's not about to turn up. But what if he heard them thinking the kingdom was about to come, and actually he said, yes, it is. I'll tell you this parable to show you how it is about to happen. The first two ways I've interpreted it place you as a reader at the start of the story where the king has just gone away and you're looking forward into how are we going to choose to live till he comes back. But you can also read it from the other end, that you read this parable standing with the king as he comes back, looking backwards and looking into the near immediate, the time of reckoning. If Jesus spoke it in this way, then the time of being away is the time that Isaiah speaks of, the time of return from the land. The promised return is now. Jesus has come now. And the ones who are going to be found wanting will be those of the Jewish people who don't recognise that he has come back appointed as king, the nobleman who went away to have his kingly power appointed has returned. It's very strong language because they reject him as if he was a tyrant master, when perhaps he's been portrayed as a generous lord. So then, in this context, it's the Jewish leaders being represented by the statement, we do not want this man to be our king. And it won't end well for them. The nasty language that we hear at the end is within the frame of the parable, which you always have to hold a bit lightly. The parables use storytelling language. But within the same chapter, we end at verse 27. By verse 41 of the same chapter, Jesus stands at Jerusalem and weeps and looks at them and says, how I longed for you to come and you didn't, and this city will be destroyed. Perhaps that's the link the parable is making. Not that the Lord smites them, but that this destruction is coming for those who couldn't see the king had come. It's possible that the bit about the coins in the middle is talking about a sterile practice of the law, that the Jewish leaders have not used the law in a way that passes it on to benefit others, that the Torah has not been allowed to create its future, it's been bound up and only looks backwards. Now, the commentators on this are very divided, because some say, no, there's plenty of evidence that the Jewish leaders of the time were passionate about their Torah and were sharing it and expanding it and using it as much as possible to extend into the community. But there's others who say their legalism was holding the Torah back. But whether it's about a failure to live out the richness of the law or just a failure to recognise Jesus' kingship, I shouldn't say just, that's a big failure, the Jewish leaders, as Jesus enters into Jerusalem, are about to have their special role taken away. The true king has arrived, where this story is told. Up to now, I've been assuming that the master figure represents God, or represents Jesus, or a combination. But what if the master doesn't represent Jesus? Then it's about, what sort of a king do you want Jesus to be? What if this is an image of what Jesus is not like? It's told to the people who expect the kingdom is at hand. They're in Jericho, approaching Jerusalem. And Jesus does not begin this parable with the kingdom of God is like, which in many others he does. He tells a story that sounds a lot like Archelaus, the son of Herod. When Herod died, Archelaus had to go to Rome to have his power as king confirmed. And a delegation of 50 Jews went after him to say to Rome, do not make this man king. We do not want this man to be our king. He was made an ethnarch, which was not quite as powerful as he was hoping for. It was pretty powerful. And he ruled for 10 years, from 4 BCE to 6 CE. And he was such a tyrant that the Romans removed him from power. Now, considering who the Romans allowed to govern, to be such a tyrant, the Romans would remove you from power, gives you some indication of the sort of man we're talking about. This is the Herod who, in Matthew's gospel, when Jesus and his parents have fled to Egypt, they return to Nazareth rather than Bethlehem because they hear that Archelaus has taken power and they don't want to go back where he's the king. We don't have absolute evidence that he destroyed those 50 Jews who went after him, but certainly Josephus, the first century historian, alludes to that, and it's well within his known character. In fact, it would be outrageous within his known character for him to have let them get away with it. And his palace was in Jericho. So what if Jesus hears them expecting a kingdom coming in a standard model by power and force? So he said, look, this is what that sort of kingdom is like. And he uses their well-known local story within the living memory of people in his audience. Then the voice of wisdom is those saying, we do not want this man to be our king. And they are killed. And the other voice of wisdom is the one who hides what he has because he recognises the tyranny of this king. This king reaps what he does not sow, he says. This is a metaphor in our culture, but it's not a metaphor here. This is a ruler who takes the crops of other farmers and leaves them to starve. That's what reaps what he doesn't sow means. To get ahead in this system, you have to join that rapacious behaviour. And if you oppose it, you get killed, or at the very least, you have everything taken from you. In chapter 18, Jesus has predicted his death. Chapter 19 continues with him entering on a donkey, this anti-king, a topsy-turvy, upside-down king. Perhaps this parable is showing the real king stands against this violating earthly power structure, and it's about to kill him. The real followers refuse to participate in these violating ways to be, and they're about to lose what they have. And the parable's context then says, come with me to Jerusalem and find out where there's hope in this story. I think this reading fits better with the preceding and following sections. But I also have to own up that it underplays the section about the coins. That central portion of the parable is not, you could just about have that interpretation without it. Which returns us to the arguments about was it two parables edited together? But I think it is a reminder to us that the strongest figure in a parable is not necessarily representing God. And the character we most intuitively associate with is not necessarily representing us. What if we're not meant to focus on the third servant, who we all read this and we go, I'm with him and he got done. What if we're meant to associate ourselves with the first servant, who is given and then fortuitously gains more and then is given even more again? Then it's a tale of generosity and abundance, and it's not about injustice and fear. I'm going to very briefly mention another way of reading parables. This is from John Dominic Crossan, and he looks at the parables over the whole of the Gospels together, and he looks at the patterns of all the ones that include masters and servants. And he suggests that there's a suite of parables that deliberately set up the normal order of masters and servants and then progressively undermine it. And that you need to read them all together, all the master and servant parables, to understand any of them. And this one is, in his reading, towards the start of that, in part of the setting up, rather than the undermining, because it basically, he says, reflects the standard order. But the flag is where it says, to those who have much, more will be given, and to those who have little, what little they have will be taken. That's not quite the standard order of things. And that's, he says, a flag to say, read this with all the others, because something else is also happening here. And the point for him overall is a reversal of expectation. That God's graciousness shatters our understanding of the order of things and also shatters our understanding of graciousness. I've got one more interpretation, if your brains aren't exploding yet. And if you're only listening to bits, this is the one where I sit. Not all the time, but best at the moment today. So if you're only listening to a bit. I think this is a parable about the consequences of fear. And it's meant to be showing that fear is unwarranted. The third servant is the one who gets the most attention, which can be a clue that that's where we're meant to put our attention. Not, therefore, what did the other guys do right, but what did this guy do wrong? Perhaps we don't need to worry about what the other guys did right at all. What did the third person do wrong? And fear was his error. All the evidence that we are actually given shows a generous master. He gives his property to his servants to trade with until his return. He's never shown with any intention of claiming that money back. He doesn't actually seem concerned with the potential for that money to be lost. When he returns, he calls the servants to find out if the money's made profit, but he doesn't claim it back. This can be seen because when The third servant's coin is taken from him and given to the first one. The bystanders say, but he's got 10. Now, if the master was claiming back his money, they would all have nothing at this point. But he's got 10. He also gives these first two servants government of a whole lot of cities. Personally, I'm not sure if that would be a blessing or a curse, but I think it's intended here as a blessing. And yet the third servant constructs him as a harsh, severe man. All the readings we've done so far, we have assumed that he was right and that he had other evidence that we hadn't seen. But what if he's wrong? Then the master in the parable is furious because his character has been misrepresented. His invitation to trust has been spurned and turned into fear. And he has been insulted. The call to us is, do we act on what we think God is like and therefore fail to experience what God is like? Robert Farah Capon says, the servant with his little shovel and his mousy apprehension that God is as small as himself is such a nerd. And the master doesn't defend himself, but responds to the servant on the servant's terms. He says, out of your own mouth I condemn you. That is, with the words you are using is what I will use to come back. This is not my way, but it's your way. Your words have created your reality. You want a harsh God? Well, now you've got a harsh God. Perhaps this is a consequence rather than a punishment. The third servant's fear of the master freezes him out of the future. He cannot move forward into the life that the master is handing out. And the third servant loses what he didn't want anyway. One member of my household, who will remain unnamed, doesn't like many foods. And Tyson is a fantastic cook, and he cooks up these amazing meals and puts them in front of said member, and it's rejected. Sometimes this person will go hungry rather than eat the very good food in front of them. And we are of an inclination now to say, well, if you don't want it, we'll give it to someone else and we can eat it while it's still warm. And it makes us cross. And we are heard to say, you didn't even taste it. This is what I think we've got here. We've got the master who's prepared this fantastic benefit for his servants, and there's one who wouldn't even taste it. And perhaps he's not actually punished, but freed from a weight of something he didn't want to, something he resented, something that was making him feel afraid that he had a debt to God that he could somehow stuff up. And perhaps those who opposed the king were afraid too. Perhaps they saw a gracious king and they said, we can't bear that. They didn't want to participate in that sort of kingship, in that sort of life. And in the end, the king says, well, if you don't want to be part of this life, then go. So are we afraid? Am I afraid? Yes. If I'm really honest. If I only try to live God's way because God is watching, then I'm motivated by fear. This classic, what would we do if nobody's watching, sets us up to check our behaviour in those circumstances. Are we really loving or are we afraid? What are we afraid of? Are we minimising our risk, playing it safe, living a low-risk spiritual life in which you neither love much nor sin much? I'm quoting Robert Capone again. What feels like a risk to you? What do you fear? And this is different for each of us. Whatever it is, fear crushes relationships. This is a relationship problem, not an action problem. Fear leads to small lives. The third servant lives the smallest life of all. She can't flourish because she's afraid. The other servants, they trust the graciousness that they've been showed and they lead lives that grow and expand. Love has wide arms, but fear makes us narrow. And yet our religious tradition has a long history of peddling fear. Out of a belief that moral action depends on fear. But God is not focused on moral action. God is focused on loving us and being loved by us. The Gospels nowhere tell us to be afraid of God. Nowhere. In fact, often it says, fear not. The only piece that says, fear God, is in the context of the Sermon on the Mount and also told in Luke, where Jesus says to them, don't fear the people who can harm your body. If you're going to be afraid of God who has the power over you. But God cares for every silly sparrow and knows every hair on your head. So if that's what you need to fear, you don't have to fear anything. The only other place in the New Testament where we are told to fear God is within a context where some of the Gentiles, Paul is writing to some of the Gentiles who are crowing over their good fortune at having been brought into the gospel and laughing at the Jews who've been left out. And it's in a context of saying, don't you dare limit God's graciousness. You be afraid of God if you're going to try and close that gap down. Perhaps quite similar to those who were opposing gracious king, opposing graciousness being crowned as king. I think this is the tremendous risk that God takes, to do away with fear in the hope that we will love. And this is the master we are responding to, the one who took the risk to love us. Which is where we get to the piece I asked Luke to read from 1 John, that God is love, and we come to judgment without fear, because we are perfected in God's love, and love drives out fear. We have oodles of time. So if you want to stay with that moment and go walk out in the sunshine, you're very welcome. If you'd like to ask questions, you're very welcome.
Hang on, John.
I've always been puzzled by the fact that the story seems to start with the king or the master or whoever it is gives his servants money on trust. It still belongs to the king. And the ones who make a profit, it ends up, it sounds as though it's their money. Well, that's just the anomaly in the story. I'm just wondering whether I'm taking... That wasn't the point. You were supposed to get some other point out of it. But you see the point. The master's giving them money on trust, and then in the end, he says, give this extra money to the one who has 10, but it suddenly becomes his money.
I think we have long read it as being given on trust, but I don't know that that's actually there. It's given, and then we interpret it from that point. Maybe it was just given. Oh, what? Tony's got the shell.
I've got the wand. I'm trying to hear it as God's given us all grace.
One over here and one over there a minute ago.
All right, I've got it. I guess I'm struggling with the idea that this was delivered to a highly collectivist culture. And as a very individual cultures, the idea of love over fear is deeply appealing because as an individual, I find it much easier to love. But I wonder in collectivist culture how important the role of fear was. We cannot possibly understand how important the bind of a community was and what the payoff, I guess, between love and fear in binding that community.
I think absolutely. And I think that's one of the other things. We often read parables assuming the strong character is God. Our favourite character is us, and it's an individualist moral response that's being presented, and I think all three of those we need to question every time. So definitely it's written to a collective culture. I suspect it's even more radical into that than into our individual culture, because fear has a strong bonding sense, and particularly in a Jewish culture, the boundaries, the way the law held the boundaries, both to wrap you in a positive sense, but also to very firmly keep others out and keep you from falling out. It's very important.
Claire, at the start you said that this was sitting in between the two sections, between
Zacchaeus and the entry to Jerusalem.
Yes. Now that we've absorbed the parable a little bit more, would you help out by taking us back there and putting that context back there for us? Well, for me anyway, is it?
I think the graciousness of Jesus in bringing God's welcome into Zacchaeus is startling and radical, because Zacchaeus is hated and he should never be permitted back in because he's done dreadful things. He's ripped off his own people. And he's probably feared also. There's a sense of that. So there's that sense of continuing the sense of graciousness. This is the King of graciousness. And then he tells his story about, you know, why are you offended about this? Do you not want me to be king, this graciousness? Do you not want it to run this way? Tells his story and then enters into Jerusalem on the donkey, the upside down sense of, I'm not the sort of king that you're hoping for, I'm this upside down king, I'm the king of love, working towards ultimately the passion story, which is the outworking of that love. Does that help? Yeah.
I have a comment of something I'd like to see in the parable, where you had one of the people given money and he took the risk and he went out and lost the lot. What the king would do then?
Absolutely. And do you know, I read a whole pile of commentaries and only one even dared to raise that possibility. Because it's so scary. It all works nicely as a moral tale as long as everyone's either successful or neutral. But if you have a big loser...
The other ones would have to give the money.
But I think that's what you've got. Well, we've got Zacchaeus. We've just had chapter 18 with the Pharisee and the tax collector, where we've got the big loser. And chapter 17 is the prodigal son. So we've had the big losers coming up, and now we've got neutral.
I was just interested in your reading of the parable as a kind of view of fear as kind of life-limiting or God-limiting in life. How do you explain the tension then with the end of the story, where the fear seems quite justified, to be honest, because they all wound up dead?
I think that's when we get to reading as consequence rather than punishment, that from the place of fear, they were, by their own fearfulness, prohibited, and they didn't want the life that was on offer. I mean, it's a very violent way to tell that story, to say that they bring them before me and slaughter them, but the sense of, within the hyperbolic language of a parable, this sense of, and I think that's moderated by the weeping over Jerusalem very soon after, if the destruction that comes is not what's actually wanted, but is the consequence of failing to be responsive to what's on offer. But yeah, I agree, it's a very disturbing tale in that sense, and it's because of that end point that we tend to read it and assume the third servant is right, rather than that all the evidence before is what's the greater truth. Yeah.
First of all, thank you very much for giving us a rundown of all the different interpretations, given that there are so many different streams of scholarship that follow particular lines, as you say, this cross, and there's others as well who have a particular interpretation they apply across all parables. So it's good to see all those lined up, and also thank you for giving us one which can actually take in everything that's in the parable without having to downplay any part of it. So that was very welcome. Responding to Lee's comment about what about the other scenario we don't see, I think I've heard that before in sermons and in church, where people do that thought experiment of taking it further. But the thing about a parable is it's like a joke. It has to come in one go with a punchline. It's not systematic theology as such. So if you want to see that scenario, if Jesus happened to tell another story which covered that scenario, look at that one rather than trying to extrapolate from this one.
I think also my interpretation has held together all the bits, but like all interpretations, the bit Luke's talked about is the bit that is the biggest tension in interpreting
yes.
And that you have to hold and go, well, I've had to twist this a bit to make it fit. Any interpretation has to do that. Am I okay with which bit I've twisted to hold the whole thing together?
Fair enough.
I think that's a discernment question each of us has to face each time we interpret anything.
Yep.
Gary at the back.
Thanks, great talk. I heard some time ago an interpretation that turned it all on its head and said that the master was like an economic master, and that the third servant was one that didn't participate in the economic system, and that's why he was derided by the master. But you've made me rethink that. However, and it's possible that the third one is wrong in how he responds to the master, but I'm looking at the very beginning of the parable. It says that but his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him, saying, "We do not want this man to be a king over us." So the third one wasn't the only one who had a problem with the master. Also, it's interesting that there are 10 servants at the beginning. I don't know what happened to the other 7.
They made a terrible loss.
And so the accusations that the third master and throughout that are made to the accusations that are made of the master are pretty hard to square with our general understanding of God's character. So I think I'm still thinking that the master is not God. Even though the Amplified translation pretty much says, with all its little inserts, says that it's God.
Yeah. I think not just the general character of God, but the character of God specifically told in the chapters immediately before and after, right here as well.
Yeah. I was the one that sits best with me, and I was fascinated to hear it because I've never heard it before, was I think about the fourth one where you're saying that Jesus is talking in a historical context over the possibility that it was one of the Herods. Mm. And if you accept the narrative, that is to say that it always was in that placing, in that spot in the narrative just before he entered Jerusalem, then, and also my question would be, who exactly was the audience? Because we know that there are other parts where he told Peter that he was Satan, because he said, you know, that he should suffer and die. And it's quite clear that people were disappointed with Jesus turning up on a donkey, and that they were expecting a savage king who would overthrow the Romans. Mm. And so that, to me, sits better than anyone else. I really like that one.
Well, the thing you need to... The bit you have to twist a bit for that is that all that interest in the coins in the middle doesn't mean a great deal in that interpretation. So that's where your discernment sits of how you hold the middle bit.
Thanks, Claire. That's really got me thinking.
Thank you, Tricia. Tricia asked me to speak on this one today, so it's her fault.
Yes, my fault. Actually, when you're talking about what the gift was at the beginning, got me thinking, I wonder if it was God's love that had been given to the Jews, and instead of sharing it and being a blessing to all nations, they wanted to sit on it and keep it to themselves. But then I moved on. When you were talking about the end bit about fear, my reaction was fairly personal, in that it reminds me of my work situation at the moment, where I'm working for an organisation that's rather a tyrant. And is my reaction to that situation to sort of cower and shrink and become reactive, or do I take the opportunity regardless and do what I believe God wants me to do and be in that situation? So for me, the king isn't God, it's a tyrant, but it's all about how I respond in that setting anyway. Do I take the opportunity, or do I just not value what I've got and become fearful and timid and useless?